Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture of Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, by the Sunni insurgents of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, who have routed the U.S.-trained and equipped Iraqi army and are now taking over to Crete, 90 miles north of Baghdad. Veteran former CIA officer Robert Baer, who was in charge of the CIA's operation in northern Iraq between the two wars, joins us to discuss yet another tragic chapter in the disastrous fallout from the Bush-Cheney intervention in Iraq that now has Iraq poised to disintegrate, with the possibility of a radical Islamic State emerging in western Iraq and eastern Syria. Then we'll get an analysis of the surprising upset victory by David Brat, an insurgent Tea Party candidate who defeated the Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in the Virginia primary. Dan Palazzola, who is a professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Richmond, who knows David Brat, joins us to discuss Brat's populist anti-Wall Street campaign and the irony that the candidate, who was outspent 40-1 by the Washington insider who had courted the Tea Party in his quest for political power, was trounced by a Tea Party candidate. Then finally, we'll go to London, England, to speak with Karen Naimer, the director of the Program on Sexual Violence in Conflict Zones at Physicians for Human Rights. She joins us from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict, and we will talk about sexual violence and rape as a weapon of war in conflicts in Bosnia, the Congo, Somalia, and now Nigeria, where Boko Haram's kidnapping of over 200 schoolgirls to become sex slaves has galvanized world opinion and brought more than 140 nations to the summit, open Tuesday, by actress and UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie and British Foreign Secretary William Hague. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. Baer is now an intelligence analyst at CNN, and he's also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And as of now, we know that ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, have taken over most of Anbar province, including Fallujah, that they've held for the last 6 months. They've now taken over Mosul, and they're driving south and east towards the capital of Sahadun province, Samarra, towards the oil-rich region around Kirkuk, and of course they have surrounded Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. At what point do you think this will stop?
Well, the question is, they're getting very close to Baghdad. And I can't imagine they're capable of taking Baghdad in the next couple of days. But I would say that both Turkey and Iran will consider intervening. I mean, the seriousness of this I can't overstate. There has never been a group more radical in Takfiris, as they say, to hold so much territory. I mean, ISIS makes the Taliban look very, very moderate. I mean, these are serious people, and they apparently know how to fight. And the borders, for instance, I've known this for about 6 months, that Jordan has been sealed. People that I know, that I talk to the tribes with in Anbar, just can't cross anymore. This is, and the old tribal structure in Anbar province, which we had used in the surge in 2007, is gone. The leadership has failed to get any concessions out of Maliki, and younger people are, Iraqis are going to ISIS. So, this could seriously blow up.
Well, they're certainly more radical than Al-Qaeda, and they've essentially Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, who, by the way, the U.S. jailed in 2005 in Iraq, where he was radicalized by Al-Qaeda. In jail, he's left Zawahiri in the dust, hasn't he? I mean, he's the poster boy now of jihadism.
You consider these people have been thrown out of Al-Qaeda because they were too radical. That's saying a lot. You know, and they intend to start a total, full-on sectarian war in Iraq. If they take Samarra, they will destroy the shrine there, the one that was blown up in 2006. If they take Baghdad, and it's a big if again, I could see the Shia population heading south. And, you know, and my question is, will the Iranians in particular put up with this? Will they feel like they're going to need to go in and use their air power, which opens up all sorts of other problems?
And, of course, the ISIS have already taken control of Iraq's most important power generating station at Beji. So they are, I mean, this is what I find extraordinary, Robert Baer, is that just yesterday in the State Department's daily briefing, Jen Psaki, tried to defend the Obama administration's support for Maliki. Not that I blame Obama for Iraq. I think it's clearly Bush and Cheney and the neocons. But she was listing the weapons that we've given to Maliki lately, and that includes a delivery of 300 Hellfire missiles, millions of rounds of small arms. I'm just quoting what she said. Thousands of rounds of tank ammunition, helicopter-fired rockets, machine guns, grenades, flares, sniper rifles, M16 and M4 rifles. We also delivered Bell helicopters, 10 Scan Eagle surveillance platform. We've moved the Apache lease case forward, and we've recently notified Congress of an additional sale of $1 billion in arms, including up to 200 Humvees. Now, most of that stuff is now in the hands of these radicals. I mean,
precisely, and they also have tanks, which makes it even worse. They have armor, and you can move fast in a place in Iraq with armor. And you've got the disintegration of the Shia army and the defection of all the Sunnis. The Sunnis have just been handing their weapons over. So in effect, this obviously wasn't the intent. In our desperation to get out of Iraq, we've in effect armed al-Qaeda or an al-Qaeda-like organization. I understand the Obama administration is going to blame for this. We should have left the army in Iraq as we are in Afghanistan. The problem is, and we have to keep on bringing this to the fore, is that our army's tired out. I spent a lot of time with these people, and they're tired of 5, 6, 7 deployments. They're coming home to broken families, divorces, and the rest of it. And not only that, they can't get jobs, so they get out of the military. So we've pretty well used up the army. So we don't really have much of a choice except get out of Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what I'm saying is there's no easy solution to this, and there's absolutely no point blaming Obama for it.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's now an intelligence analyst at CNN and is the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So apart from blaming Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice and company for getting us into this war, or actually more specifically lying us into this war, the fact that the neocons in the Pentagon, Wolfowitz and Feith, disbanded the Iraqi army, which then began the insurgency. Instead of having 400,000 guys to keep the peace and maintain the borders, you ended up with 400,000 angry, armed insurgents. And I take it you just referred to this a minute ago. That was the beginning of this chain of events that's led to today.
Well, yeah, you know, look, here's the problem. Is when Bremer went in and led the coalition government, the provisional government there, a friend of mine was in the meetings, and he specifically wouldn't let anybody who knew Iraq in or anybody who spoke Arabic. He just didn't want to know. And he disbanded the army, took their weapons away, set up this makeshift army. And, you know, Petraeus was part of this too, which was untrained. It had no cohesion. And surprise, surprise, 2 years after we leave, or 3 years after we leave Iraq, it falls apart. It's been falling apart for the last 8 months. Where the press just hasn't covered it. You know, see pictures, you know, just incredibly whole units just defecting, leaving their arms. So they're better, but they are probably as well armed as the Iraqi army is now, and they certainly are more motivated. And that's why people who really know Iraq are saying it's unclear how far south they'll go. The Shia are mostly in the south. I don't think they're going to make it to Basra, but they could take large parts of Baghdad, or at least provoke some sort of, you know, really a battle for that city.
So, Robert Baer, your friend Ayad Alawi, who actually won the first election and then he got cheated out of it by Maliki about the prime ministership. And ever since, Maliki has been completely partisan and sectarian in his outlook, and he's marginalized the Sunnis and added fuel to this fire, has he not?
He completely marginalized. Not only that, he trumped up charges against various Sunni leaders, the old traditional ones, that might have held Iraq, the Sunni community together. So with all, with them disaffected and disregarded, you have a lot of younger people who are just angry. They thought they got cheated in 2007 by turning against Al Qaeda. They expected to be rewarded, and what we did instead when we pulled out was simply turn over everything to the Shia, who also the leadership is absolutely totally corrupt, oil deals and everything else. As far as the Kurds go, which are the northeast of the country, they're a separate nation for all intents and purposes.
So what's your sense then of the idea that you have this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, of course, meaning from Baghdad, right? And he's heading to Baghdad now with his army, ISIS. The U.S. has got a $10 million bounty on his head. These people, obviously, their problem, they may be good at taking territory and winning battles, but once they take over, they impose Sharia law, which has become very unpopular in parts of Syria where they've taken over. So the assumption is that they can win battles, but they can't sustain. Do they have any kind of governance program apart from Sharia law?
No, they can't govern. You can't govern based on the Quran alone. I think, even the Salafis understand that, but these people don't, and they're certainly going to try. The point is, how much destruction can they do before the Sunni community eventually turns against them? And I say they'll do a lot of destruction. They will destroy that in society in so many ways, and Iraq will become much more of a basket case than it already is, and that's saying a lot.
So we have this ironic situation now, then, it would seem, that the U.S. may find itself in alliance with Iran.
I wrote a book on this. It said, look, we may not like the Iranians, and yes, they did commit terrorism against us in the 80s, but the point is they are a country, and they are a responsible power at this point, and they do work within their borders, and they have, for instance, since 2006, kept a lid on Hezbollah, a very tight one, too. And you can negotiate with them. And I think what we're seeing now is that Saudi Arabia is starting to talk to the Iranians as well, because they're panicked. They're panicked that this chaos in Iraq is going to come south, move into Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf. We call it the Muslim Brotherhood, call it ISIS, whatever you want. So it's wild that a year after this break between the United States and Saudi Arabia over Iran, the Saudis have come around and seen the point. And this is just a sign of their panic.
So specifically, what might happen in terms of an Iranian intervention?
Well, I think it's going to be simply to protect the Shia population. If they take Samarra tonight, I think one of the first things they'll do is they'll take one of the 12 Imam's shrines and blow it up, as they did in 2006, which started the entire civil war in Iraq. I think it'll start there, and I think they'll start slaughtering Shia just based on the sectarian, because they look at them as having fallen away from Islam, and that they have the right to execute them, if you like, or kill them. Because they have been executing Christians and other people. And again, they have taken over the Turkish consulate in Mosul and grabbed all the diplomats and their children, taken them hostage. Wait until, you know, if they decide to execute them. With the Turks, they don't fool around with this sort of thing. But, you know, how do you turn back a movement like this? It's a question. So the Turks and the Iranians, it would be very much a defensive act that they would go into Iraq.
Well, wouldn't the Turks have a problem having to go through Kurdish territory?
I think the Kurds would probably let them at this point.
Uh-huh.
The Kurds have an agreement with Turkey on all sorts of levels.
Sure. Well, they're the biggest trading partner, aren't they?
Yeah, and the Kurds are very upset about this too, about what's happened to the Sunni. They've been courting the moderate tribal leaders, but I think the moderate tribal leaders, as far as I can see, are irrelevant.
So, just in the last couple of minutes, then, the idea that you could end up—I mean, we're talking about countries that literally their borders were drawn up 100 years ago by the British and French. At the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, is there a possibility that there would be a new Islamic State there in Western Anbar and Eastern Syria?
I think we have one. I think it's a fait accompli. That's what we have. I mean, how long it survives is another question. But I mean, it all seems to be the same. You know, Baghdadi is an Iraqi. It's not his real name, but the point is he's an Iraqi, but it's the whole idea of Salafi Islam and Takfiri Islam, which is just exclude anybody who's not, it doesn't accept your beliefs. And that would be all moderate Muslims, Christians, and Shia.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's now an intelligence analyst at CNN and is the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a friend of the candidate who just won and toppled the House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Palazzolo, who is a professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Richmond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Palazzolo.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And your district, the 7th District, the Congressional District in Virginia, has been the site of a political earthquake with the Majority Leader of the House, Eric Cantor, losing this primary election to a relative unknown, David Bratt, who teaches at the Randolph Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. So you're there on the ground. I guess none of the pundits predicted this, and I imagine it caught you by surprise too.
Yes, it did. The only prospect that most people held for an upset was if a lot of Democrats got into the election. It's an open primary, and so therefore there was a theory out there that somehow Democrats would be mobilized to vote against Eric Cantor. There really was not a big organized campaign of Democrats. I really think this was a big surprise, and it happened partly because people like me underestimated the power of the grassroots within the Republican Party.
And the popularity, apparently, of this upstart candidate, David Bratt, who I think since Cantor won the last time has been posting some fairly aggressive pieces about him, and so much so that he caught the attention of some of the conservative television and radio personalities like Laura Ingraham. He'd apparently been posting stuff on the Daily Caller, a conservative news site. Did you have any inkling of who this fellow was?
I've known David for quite a while, and he's someone who's very bright, and he sort of stayed involved in local politics. Never got deeply involved, but he knew a lot of people, and he was watching. He was watching the district. He was watching Congressman Cantor, and I think he observed the kind of growing distance that he talked about in his campaign about the Cantor being more involved with the majority leadership in the House, less involved with his district, and I think that became kind of the basis of his campaign message. And I think that kind of carried on. I think that's going on within the Republican Party. There, not to overuse the cliche, but there is a kind of tension between the establishment and the grassroots. And many of those in the grassroots are disillusioned with leaders of the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., and Cantor was among them.
So in terms of the turnout, though, it would indicate to me that that is a big factor because in the 2012 general election, Eric Cantor had a fairly stunning victory over his Democratic opponent with 223,000 votes.
Right.
He lost in this election. Bratt got 36,000 and Cantor got 29,000,
right,
and only 65,000 people showed up.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, one of the curious things about American politics is how few people show up to vote, right?
The primary election, you're right. I mean, the more relevant comparison is the last primary that he ran in. And turnout was much higher this time than it was in the last primary. So these primary elections definitely have a smaller electorate, but in this case, Bratt, mobilized them. I think there's a couple of things that I would say that people should know about here locally. One was that the sort of some Tea Party activists who began to protest against the health care law back in September of 2013, and they protested outside of Cantor's office, basically arguing that he should vote to defund Obamacare. And if not, we should shut the government down. I mean, this is this kind of tactics they were trying to deploy him to use, and he was hesitant to do that. And then we had a governor's race in which Ken Cuccinelli, who was a Tea Party favorite, lost to the Democrat Terry McAuliffe, but by a very small margin. And there were those among the Tea Party who said the establishment had abandoned Cuccinelli. Okay, so there's a context here. There's a growing sort of anger and activism among the Tea Party base in Virginia and in the 7th District. And there's also a pretty significant rural part of Cantor's district where cultural conservatives kind of can voice their opinion. So I think there's a context here that's in some ways peculiar to the 7th, but also touches on some of the things that are happening nationally.
And how much has the 7th been gerrymandered? Because I believe in the 7th voted for Obama, didn't it?
You're thinking of Henrico County.
Uh-huh.
Henrico County did vote for Obama, and it voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012. And that is where Cantor's office is located. But his district reaches up into parts of the northern part of into Hanover, which is very conservative, up into Spotsylvania County. It goes south into what's called New Kent, and it does not have the more liberal part of Henrico, okay? In Henrico County, which sort of circles Richmond, Virginia, the urban area, there's an eastern end and a western end, and the western end is pretty reliably Republican. The eastern end is more Democratic. And that eastern end is actually in Bobby Scott's district. He's in the adjoining congressional district. So, but the 7th district is very reliably Republican, pretty conservative, and it was kind of gerrymandered in that way, partly to achieve the majority-minority district that, you know, Bobby Scott represents under the Voting Rights Act. So,
again, I'm speaking with Dan Palazzolo, who is a professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Richmond, which is in the 7th District, right?
Yes, it is.
And the 7th District of Virginia that just had this upset election. Now, the Democrat that's going to be running against him, of course, is from he's a fellow professor at the same college,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. But he doesn't have a snowball.
If I got in, we'd have another professor. Maybe we need another professor in the race.
Right, but he doesn't have a snowball's chance, does he, just based on what you just told us about how much the district is gerrymandered?
You'd have to be a little humble as a political analyst today, right, trying to predict any election, and so I'm not going to go there. But I think there's a chance there may be an independent in the race. It's not clear to me. Eric Cantor just did a press conference, mm-hmm, in Washington, and he was very gracious in defeat. So it's not like he's, you know, trying to encourage someone to run. But I can tell you that there are a lot of Republicans who are not real happy, you know, with David Bratt. And so there is always the possibility that someone could run as an independent. Cantor cannot run as an independent, but someone could. That could create an opening for the Trammell, who's obviously also a very much a novice candidate. The Democrats, he's a sociologist at Randolph Macon. But my guess is that if it stays a two-party race, then it'll be Bratt will win the race because it's so strongly Republican.
Well, you mentioned a little while ago, Dan Palazzolo, that you know David Bratt.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a sense of who he is. And I mean, his writing, his works include God and Advanced Mammon, Can Theological Types Handle Usury, right, and Capitalism, and an analysis of the moral foundations in Ayn Rand.
Right.
So how much of a Tea Party candidate is he, given that the Tea Party is, it's a sort of amorphous group, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people claim to be the Tea Party, including the people who just shot the policeman in Las Vegas. So it's a loose term as far as I can tell, but it seems to be, you know, the right wing of the Republican Party. It's the best definition for it.
Well, first of all, the thing about David is that he doesn't really personally associate himself with the Tea Party. I think it's more likely that the Tea Party had formed a kind of anybody but Cantor kind of mentality. And when I say Tea Party here, I mean people who kind of got into politics, focused primarily on fiscal issues. But increasingly, at least here in Virginia, the Tea Party has really focused on things like immigration, and, you know, gay marriage and gun rights. And so those are more cultural issues. And Cantor today even reminded us all that Tea means taxed enough already. And that's where it all started, which was much more of a free enterprise, limited government kind of notion. Now, David is a capitalist, free enterprise economist. And in that sense, he has a lot in common with the Tea Party. I think he also is someone who was critical of Cantor's ties to Wall Street and to what he called big business. And he effectively aligned that with immigration reform. Even though that Cantor is not a big believer in immigration reform, he did say that he thought we needed to find a way to incorporate children of undocumented people into American society. And so he was, you know, looking for some kind of modest immigration change in immigration law. David claimed that that was tantamount to amnesty, which is really a stretch in a way. But what he was doing was he was tying it to the idea of corporations wanting cheap labor. And so, you know, he very much ran a kind of a campaign that was focused on economic issues, right? And what he was arguing basically was that Cantor was not paying attention to the average guy, the Main Street, the guy on Main Street. He cared more about Wall Street and big banks and big corporations. And that was the basis, that was a reason sure. why Cantor was more open to immigration reform. So he's definitely very conservative. There's no question about it. But I do think what you're going to see with Bratt is someone who's interested in policy analysis. I mean, he would not say to you, if he were talking to you, he would not say, well, yeah, I'm a conservative. He wouldn't define himself that way. I mean, he would use that language, but he would say he'd be much more focused on policy and ways of reducing government, you know, regulation, that sort of thing.
Well, Dan Palazzolo, given that he said a vote in campaign saying a vote for Eric Cantor is a vote for open borders, a vote for Eric Cantor is a vote for amnesty, obviously that resonated. But the other stuff that you talked about, particularly the idea that he tied emigration to exploitation of cheap labor by big corporations, my understanding is that he did run in many ways as a populist. And that, of course, Cantor has been very Wall Street friendly, and his wife's an investment banker with Goldman Sachs. So it would seem to me that wasn't he talking about the Stock Act that Cantor basically... Didn't Cantor water down the Stock Act, et cetera? I mean, give me a sense of the specifics he said about Wall Street.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of people, I watched some national news coverage last night, and a lot of people say, oh, it's all about immigration. They narrowed it all down to immigration. Well, I think it is true that the amnesty, the attack on Cantor and claiming that he supported amnesty, did rile up certain people. You know, I mean, 36,000 people voted for him, and I'm sure some of them care a lot about, you know, immigration and amnesty or what have you, but not all of them do. I mean, I think the bigger question here, the bigger narrative was that, you know, in the process of trying to make conservatism work or in the process of trying to negotiate deals on Capitol Hill, Cantor had become increasingly distant from his constituents. And that is the bigger story that Bratt tried to tell. And I think that's the story that resonated most. That was the point that people focused in on. They started to say, yeah, you're right. You know, Cantor sort of talks about being conservative, but, you know, he's cutting deals with Wall Street bankers and Wall Street interests. And it's everything from the Stock Act, you know, to, you know, working with hedge fund managers at the margins to keep them from being overtaxed, you know, you name it, you know. And so he was criticizing Cantor's alignment with the special interest. And here's where the Tea Party movement, if you will, has something in common on the right, has something in common with the left, who have attacked Wall Street and calling for, you know, talking about the 1% or what have you. That is to say that there's this kind of oligarchy out there, and Republican leaders who align themselves with corporate interests are really not representing the people. I mean, this is part of the sort of language of the Tea Party. So in that sense, Occupy Wall Street and certain strains of the Tea Party movement are actually quite consistent with each other in the sense that it's the us versus the elites, right? And so I think some of that, Bratt definitely tapped into that.
And he used the the word or the phrase crony capitalism a lot, didn't he?
He did. I mean, and you know, the other thing about Brad is, and here's the other difference. I mean, you're talking about somebody who's a college professor, and he's very knowledgeable about public policy, and he can go into a room and he can talk to people about public policy. They can put it into their terms. So we're not talking about some fly-by-night, okay, I think I'll take on the majority leader. We're talking about a very bright guy who was able to walk into a room and gain some legitimacy. And he worked very hard at the grassroots level to reach out to people. So that's part of the story as well.
Well, Dan Palazzolo, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate the fact that you know the candidate well and were able to give us this insight.
All right. Thanks. Enjoyed talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Palazzolo, who is the Professor of Political Science and the Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Richmond. We're going to take a brief station break and go to London to talk about the Conference on Sexual Violence in Conflict Zones. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Karen Naimer, who is the director of the Program on Sexual Violence in Conflict Zones at Physicians for Human Rights. She joins us from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen Naimer.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, along with Angelina Jolie, who is, of course, a well-known actress and also a UN Special Envoy, opened the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. And give me a sense of how the conference is going and who's attending and what you expect in terms of an agenda going forward.
The conference has about, I think they mentioned, almost 2,000 delegates from around the world. The delegates range from states, people, delegates from representing different governments around the world, as well as practitioners from communities all around the world. So, for example, Physicians for Human Rights has brought about 30 delegates from sub-Saharan Africa, largely from Eastern Congo and from Kenya. And our delegates range from doctors, police officers, lawyers, and judges. But there are delegates here who are human rights activists and human rights defenders and documenters. They really range civil society organizations, public health practitioners. So really quite broad. Overall, I would say that the tone and spirit of the conference is really quite grateful. People are excited to be here. People feel a lot of gratitude towards the British government and Foreign Secretary Hague for bringing us all together and creating a platform where delegates from all walks of life, from all around the world, have a chance to connect with each other, really in, for the first time, to have access to policymakers and activists and to share their stories. And I know for our delegates who come from very small communities in Eastern Congo and Kenya, this for them is a tremendous opportunity to share their stories and feel like their voice is being heard by people who otherwise wouldn't have the chance to hear it.
And, of course, Angelina Jolie made a film a few years ago, In the Land of Blood and Honey. I believe that film's going to be shown, but it was released in 2011, and it's set against the backdrop of the war in Bosnia, and it deals with the issue of violence against women in war zones and rape, etc., as a weapon of war. This is clearly something that that she has been interested in for some time, right?
So, yes, in fact, she has been interested in this for some time. Foreign Secretary Haig was told about the film by one of his advisors back in 2012. And when he saw the film, he was so taken with how harrowing it is for survivors to obtain any justice and how justice tends to fail them, and how little accountability there is for those who perpetrate these crimes, that he decided in the spring of 2012 to make sexual violence and ending impunity for sexual violence his signature issue while he's been in office. And so consequently, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the equivalent of the State Department for the United Kingdom, launched this very bold initiative to focus on ending impunity for sexual violence. And this summit is really the apex, the highlight of that initiative.
And again, I'm speaking with Karen Naimer, who is in London. She's the director of the program on sexual violence in conflict zones at Physicians for Human Rights. And she joins us from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. And the fact that there are a delegation of 20 women from the town in northern Nigeria, Chibok, where over 200 girls were kidnapped recently by Boko Haram, I take it that that kidnapping, which has gained international attention, and the fact that you have women from the same town, presumably many of whom either are related to the girls who have disappeared, but certainly would know them, that I would suggest perhaps that that incident has sort of spurred people's attention around the world and perhaps led to a number of delegations showing up. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. That event, recent events that have happened in Nigeria have really galvanized people to speak out about the issues of sexual violence. It certainly has become an issue that, you know, is much more publicized as a result. In many communities, and consequently, you're seeing that conversation really emerge and surface in the discussions here. What we are seeing also, though, is that that is just one example of many, many devastations that are going on in many different communities, and that is certainly a launching pad for talking about many similar issues in other communities, but that is just one example. So, you know, imagine that example multiplied by tens or hundreds, and you're really getting many, many stories of just real struggle and devastation by different communities, and also incredible stories of resilience among survivors.
And the countries, of course, where there has been wholesale violence against women in conflict and rape as a weapon of war. Of course, Bosnia, we mentioned, Somalia, and the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, Boko Haram. But the Republic of Congo is where there's been an enormous amount of violence against women for the longest time, along with the fact that something like 5 million people have died. I understand that there have been efforts to bring some of these warlords and militia to justice in the Congo. What's the sort of suggestions here in terms of methodology? Obviously, you know, you have to get in a situation where you have to have enough security in order to arrest these perpetrators. But what has happened so far in terms of efforts towards justice?
Yeah, so you're seeing quite a lot of efforts to support the justice system in Congo. In Congo, they have what are called mobile courts, and these are courts that sort of operate like American circuit courts, and they go to remote regions and set up shop there for several weeks or months at a time. There are a panel of judges and lawyers who come representing survivors or victims from the community, and they try a series of cases relating to mass crimes, The judges hear the cases, they deliver their judgments, and then they pack up and go to the next remote area. So it provides people in these remote areas with access to justice that they otherwise would not have had. And in these communities, there is a tremendous desire to hold perpetrators to account for their crimes. People are very keen, despite the risks that they will endure if they dare to speak against the perpetrators. People do come forward, and they really are keen and very eager to obtain a measure of justice. And so you are seeing this emerging justice system in Congo through the development of these mobile courts. And there has been a lot of support from the international community and from the Congolese government to support these mobile courts. But one of the biggest challenges that we're seeing with these mobile courts is that you really need strong political will to provide support for the people involved in this legal process. Because oftentimes, the most senior people who are responsible for the crimes are senior people who have associations with the military or with the government or key members of civil authority, and it's very difficult to hold them to account. So I think that there are many, many actors very deeply committed to the justice system and to seeing progress in Congo through these mobile courts, but there are deep frustrations about the limitations to that process. But nevertheless, there are very committed people who are doing the best that they can with the resources that they have. But we need more political will to allow them to do more.
But my understanding, Karen Namer, is that when these armed groups, like in the Congo, abduct these women, they take them off into the jungle and hold them as sex slaves. And a number of the women get pregnant and have children by fathered by their rapists. Have you seen or do you know of incidents where the women have confronted their rapists with child in hand?
Yes, actually, back in October of 2011, I had the opportunity to attend a mobile court hearing in a small town in eastern Congo called Kalehe. And when I was attending this mobile hearing, there were 19 women survivors who had been among 400 women who had been abducted back in 2009, so a few years before then, and taken into the bush and held there for a year until some of them managed to escape. Others, of course, were killed. But those who had escaped wanted to see the perpetrators be held responsible through a formal legal process to be held accountable for their crimes. And they came to court on this particular day that I was there. They were waiting to testify, to face their perpetrators face-to-face and tell their stories. And they were waiting all day long to testify, holding their children who were born from those rapes back when they had been abducted. So This is really a devastation that is not a one-off event. These are challenges and difficulties that people really endure for years and years. And these are just the physical manifestations. There are, of course, many psychological injuries that people endure too, but it's really devastating when you have a whole generation, a new generation of children who are born from these crimes, because it's a struggle for the parents, for the mother, it's a struggle for the children, for the communities, for the families that they're born into. Many, many people suffer, and they suffer as a result for generations.
So, Karen Namer, as I mentioned earlier, the conference that you're attending in London, Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict, was opened by the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, and also the actress and UN Special Envoy, Angelina Jolie. At the opening, Ms. Jolly said, we need to shatter that culture of impunity and make justice the norm, not the exception, for these crimes. In terms of what you witnessed in the Congo, where the women who were abducted and held in the jungle as sex slaves, and many of whom had children, and were facing their rapists with the child in hand, what kind of justice was meted out for their benefit?
Yeah, so in that particular case, the perpetrators were convicted, and the women, as many women are, or survivors are, in these mobile court hearings, the judgments tend to award the survivors with certain reparations. The challenge, though, in Congo, as is a challenge everywhere, is that reparations have been very difficult to enforce. And so we see another challenge there that has been discussed somewhat at this summit as well, how to really ensure that survivors get the reparations that they're awarded in these cases. You know, we speak about comprehensive justice and access to justice for survivors, but access to justice really means comprehensive medical care and treatment, psychosocial support, access to bona fide investigations, bona fide prosecutions, and then enforcement of judgments when they succeed in court. And I think we're missing a big piece of that justice process when survivors fail to obtain the reparations they correctly won.
So in terms of the conference, which I believe ends on Friday, what will be, what do you expect, Karen Namer, to be the resolutions going forth, particularly with the involvement of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon? Secretary of State Kerry is also providing a statement by videotape. But I guess two questions. What are you hoping comes out of this, and what do you expect will come out of this?
I think that the framers of this summit have really tried to message to the delegates that they want the summit to be more than just inspirational words, but deeds to match, concrete, practical steps to really follow through with a lot of the words that have been shared today and in the coming days. And I think if this summit will be considered a success, it's to really see those words implemented in terms of, you know, resources for these practitioners on the ground who work with survivors every day. So more training for doctors to collect forensic medical evidence, which is something that Physicians for Human Rights has been doing in Eastern Congo and in Kenya for the last 3 years. More training for police reforms to be able to more effectively respond to survivors when they go to police stations, more training for lawyers and judges to be able to prosecute and adjudicate these cases. But it's also a real demand for resources to support every aspect of society, a demand for political will to be able to provide that protection and cover to the people who are working with survivors. So really, at every level, the goal is to really identify what are those concrete next steps that the delegates here and that the states people here can really implement going forward. And that is really what will determine whether or not this summit was a success.
And there are delegates from these countries where this problem exists of violence and conflict against women, and rape as a weapon of war. I mean, obviously Somalia is a failed state, but and Congo is in turmoil. What kind of representation is there, and by extension, how are they capable of taking responsibility?
So very interestingly, some countries have chosen to not come to the summit because it can be quite delicate for them. But other countries, like the delegation from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has quite a sizable delegation here. And I think that is a very promising development. For sure, there are a lot of challenges in Congo, but I think that we're seeing an opportunity available here for all of us to recognize that the Congolese delegation is here because they want to engage with the international community. They don't want to be pariahs. I think that they recognize that there are certain struggles in their country, but they are looking to make changes. And there are changes underway. They have made some legislative reforms and some legal reforms. They've incorporated the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. So certain mass crimes that are prosecutable under international law are also used in national jurisdictions in Congo. And these are important steps. These are important steps that help to support access to justice for survivors in Congo and elsewhere. But we really need to see greater resources devoted to allowing these stakeholders in these communities to do their job without their own risk at stake. And, of course, the political will to back the prosecution of very high-level people. So I think we're seeing changes in Congo. I think we're seeing changes in some of the other countries who are sending delegates here. There is, of course, much more work to be done. But I think that one idea that has really surfaced at this gathering is that a summit like this would not have been possible 10 years ago. Sexual violence wasn't seen as a major issue for world leaders to discuss. It was seen merely as a regrettable byproduct of war. But we are in a different stage right now. International legal principles are quite robust and are available to hold perpetrators to account for mass crimes related to sexual violence. And more we're seeing national jurisdictions incorporating those international legal principles so that one could be able to hold perpetrators to account in local jurisdictions. There's, of course, much more work to do, but these are important trends that are quite promising.
Well, I thank you so much, Karen Namer, for joining us here today from London.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Karen Namer, who is in London. She's the director of the Program on Sexual Violence in Conflict Zones at Physicians for Human Rights, and she joined us from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.